Hello there, this is Mark Bauerlein with another conversation. Before we get to it, a word about our sponsor. The University of Dallas is a premier Catholic liberal arts institution, renowned for its rigorous core curriculum and thriving graduate programs. Careers in ministry, teaching, business, humanities, and science are formed here. With campuses in Texas and Rome, Italy, students begin their pursuit of a life well lived. We have two alums of Dallas here at First Things on staff, and they are both superb. For more information on the University of Dallas, visit udallas.edu. That's udallas.edu. Aaron Zubia is professor of humanities in the Hamilton Center at University of Florida. His new book is The Political Thought of David Hume, The Origins of Liberalism and the Modern Political Imagination. That's our topic today. Welcome, Professor Zubia.
Thank you, Mark. Great to be here.
Now, first, generally speaking, I grew up with Hume as a philosopher of knowledge and induction, not of political thought. Maybe a little history. You knew Hume did some historical works, but it was always, a treatise of human nature. That was where you started with Hume and often ended. But what makes his political philosophy important? I mean, overall, before getting into specifics.
Okay. Well, first of all, you're right. I mean, even today, the treatise is read most often among university students. If it's not the treatise, it's the dialogues concerning natural religion that are, yep. That is, these dialogues are read in philosophy of religion classes. Strangely, Hume was best known in his day as an essayist and as an historian. And his essays can be conceived properly, I think, as an attempt to popularize his political philosophy, his political science. And so I think Hume's politics, his political thought, is important because he was a popularizer in his day, popularizing a kind of Enlightenment view. But beyond that, even in the present day, I think there's a big influence. When I was rereading Alistair McIntyre's After Virtue a few years ago, I saw this line where he says, "The ghost of Hume walks through John Rawls's theory of justice." And of course, Rawls is a huge figure, the major 20th century political philosopher who taught at Harvard for many years. And so that's confirmed my thought that Hume's political theory is just as important for us today.
Okay. As we begin, you quote Hume's attitude right off the bat about the dominant Christianity of his time. And maybe this is one of the things that made Hume famous in his day, but why did Hume regard that dominant Christianity as, quote, pernicious superstition?
Right. He was known as the great infidel. That was one of his nicknames. He said in an interview with James Boswell toward the end of his life that he had been raised a Calvinist but had done away with religion by the time he was about 11. And he said,
"It's kind of young, isn't it?"
That is kind of young.
And he was precocious, right?
Yeah, that's right. And he thought that religion was harmful, that it harmed morals, and he thought that there were two species of false philosophy. He says, false religion. He said superstition and enthusiasm. A superstition, he's thinking of a kind of Anglican or a Catholic high church approach where there's bishops, hierarchy, and there's a kind of superstition, a kind of subservience to authority figures. And then he thought there's a fanaticism that you might find among the Protestant reformers or the Puritans, a zeal for liberty, the kind of zeal that led to the English Civil Wars in the mid-17th century. And Hume did say in a couple of his writings, and I'm thinking about the dialogues here, that there was a true religion. But really he reduced that to morality and some conception of a first cause. At the same time, while Hume said this, or he wrote this, in his writings on causation, he really separates all links from that could possibly be made from God the Creator to Earth. I mean, he says we have no idea if this God is a moral God. We have no, if there was a creation, we don't know if it was a bungled creation. Maybe there were 15 attempts. Maybe it was three architects and they messed up. So he's, you know, through this probabilistic thinking, experimental thinking, you know, he's writing against those like William Paley, who would later write about the teleological proof of God's existence, whether it's fine-tuning or the evidence of a divine reason behind creation. Hume is arguing against this. And so I think if you're going to take his argument seriously, you know, he severs all links between God and creation. He says we basically can't know anything about God, so let's just forget all that. And that's part of his political project. Leave the metaphysics behind, and let's focus on our temporal well-being. And what I think is, gosh, it takes a whole lot of metaphysical thinking to say, let's get rid of the metaphysics. And that's part of what I try to get at in the book.
You know, I want you, Aaron, in your teaching, you know, I'm older than you are. I have more experience as a teacher, so I'm going to speak down to you, young man. repeat that to your students. It takes a whole lot of metaphysics to get rid of metaphysics. That's good. Thank you. Anyway, and people forget, you know, enthusiast, to call someone an enthusiast in 1750, that was a bad word. You know, enthusiasm, fanatical, a little, you know, crazy. Actually, the root of enthusiasm is theo. But how much did Hume's irreligiosity, that the attitude, how much did that discredit him with much of the public, or did it sort of advance him, give him notoriety, to open it up for his political essays becoming so prominent?
Yeah, a little bit of both. That's perceptive of you there. Ernest Mosner, one of the best biographers of Hume, he wrote that in the 1750s, some regarded Hume as the one who would take on the mantle of Montesquieu and be considered the greatest man of letters at that time, while there were others who thought Hume was infamous. The inheritor of the mantle of Hobbes and Mandeville, these moral and religious skeptics. So I think on that side, the latter group, probably, you know, the popular party and the Scottish Kirk, and faithful Christians of all denominations that were relevant at that time, I think they would have put Hume right there with Hobbes and Mandeville. Whereas Hume's essays were written for polite society, for those in the taverns and the gardens, polite and literate men and women interested in public affairs, they would have been drawn to Hume's cosmopolitan perspective, his notion that virtue doesn't call us to stern and austere activity and sacrifice, but instead it calls us to frolic and gaiety and charm and play. And so this was appealing, his style as an essayist. He was a great stylist. William Rose of the English, of the Monthly Review, an English periodical, said, you know, Hume had this original turn of mind. He had this perspicacity, this wit that was infectious. And he is a great writer, stylist. But the... I'll say faithful Christians are those, you know, in Scotland, you know, in the university, you started class with prayer. If you were a professor of moral philosophy, you were still teaching about pneumatology, which is, you know, the nature of the soul. And so it was expected that you would at least connect morals with religion, ground morals in religion. And Hume did not do this. And so, you know, Hume is one of these figures. He hosted great dinner parties. He was probably a lot of fun to be around. He was not an enthusiast, but when it came to his irreligion, perhaps he was more dogmatic than you would expect of a skeptic.
Well, okay, let's move into your book. You mentioned dialogues concerning natural religion. What does the term natural religion mean? Tell us.
Yeah, so I would distinguish between revelation, which is that which you receive in scripture, the Hebrew and Christian scriptures, the direct word of God. Distinguish that from natural theology, the kind of natural theology that you can even find in Plato's Timaeus or Cicero's dialogues on religion, which was somewhat of a model for Hume's own dialogues concerning natural religion. And it is what we can know about the nature and existence of God based on natural reason alone. And at the outset of the dialogues, Hume says, well, we're not going to talk about the existence of God. We're going to take that for granted, but we'll talk about his nature. What can we learn about the nature of God based on natural reason alone? And he ends up saying, not a lot.
The contrast is revelation, revealed religion. What was Hume's argument about the miracles issue?
Yeah, so
because that's the most concrete, you know, revelation, the miracle, right?
That's absolutely right. So Hume is in this position where in individual writings, right, you can see how he would try not to offend certain individuals. And of course, I'm saying this, the dialogues concerning natural religion were not published until after Hume's death. He asked Adam Smith to release them, but Smith had already gotten himself in hot water for calling Hume nearly the most perfectly virtuous man he had ever seen. And this was controversial because Hume was irreligious. So Smith backs off, and it's Hume's nephew who publishes the dialogues in 1779, 3 years after Hume's death. And even, you know, manuscripts of the dialogues have been passed around. Hume had some friends among the moderate ministers in Scotland. Hugh Blair was one of them. And Hugh Blair said, if you publish this, David, they're going to put up a statue of you in Paris, right? Because the French as the French Enlightenment was more radical, more atheistic. And one of Hume's friends said, poor guy, you know, over in France, he's not radical enough. And here in Britain, you know, he's too radical. You know, he has no home. But so Hume knew it. He knew he was causing trouble, stirring controversy. But he says just enough to sort of cover his back. So he says in the dialogues concerning natural religion, we're just talking about the nature of God, not the existence of God. And in miracles, his essay on miracles, it was excised from A Treatise of Human Nature because he knew it was going to be controversial. But then he published it in An Enquiry Concerning Human Understanding, which was published in 1748. And Hume says, all right, a miracle is a transgression of the law of nature. And how are we supposed to deal with this? If someone comes to us and says that they have witnessed a miracle, well, let's go to that which is most reliable in our experience. And that happens to be the laws of human nature, which pretty much comes to a proof, which is something that you can think of as a certainty. The sun will rise, fire is hot. These things, you can take them for granted. They happen every single time. And then you look at human nature. Well, human beings seem to be easily mistaken, easily misled, to spread gossip. And so if you're going to weigh the probability, you have the proof of a law of nature, which is called a law of nature because it's regular and uniform, or you have word of mouth of people who are not trustworthy. And that's his conclusion. So whereas John Locke said that testimony was a reliable source of knowledge, Hume rebuts that. And Hume even says, you know, if someone told you that Queen Elizabeth rose from the dead, you wouldn't believe them. And he ends up saying any faith based in miracles has pretty much been defeated here. And so, of course, he's talking about Christianity. And then he concludes saying, well, you know, the person of faith is pretty much, we can't explain that. That's a miracle in and of itself. So he makes the argument against it, but, you know, preserves some perhaps modicum of evidence for those so inclined to interpret him as a fideist, who thinks, well, there's no reason, you know, there's no rational belief, but we can take that leap of faith, and perhaps that's all we have. And really, with Hume, that's all we're left with, but he even takes that away from his hearers.
The political theory. Let's jump in. First, what is the social contract thesis and why does Hume reject it?
Yes, great question. Hume, if he's read at all in contemporary classes in political theory at the university, it's his essay of the original contract in which he refutes Locke's notion of the original contract. Now, the idea of the original contract that Hume rejects is the idea that there was a certain point in time where there was a contract whereby individuals promised obedience to the political authority in return for protection, the protection of rights, life, liberty, and property. And Hume says that this is, there's no way this can be true. This can be true because, first of all, we're born into political society, and nobody promises obedience. If you ask anybody why they obey law, obey the government, they're going to say, well, because I was born here, because that's the way that people do things. It's custom, it's habit. And so this is Hume's argument against Locke. And Locke, of course, had said, well, there's express consent, explicit consent, which is, you know, the first people who formed society, they explicitly consented and promised to obey the sovereign. But everyone thereafter expresses tacit consent, you know, by living and enjoying property, possessing some property, you know, having safe roads to travel on and trade, you're basically consenting to this. And Hume says, you know, individuals don't have the freedom of exit that you think they do. What if they don't know, they don't have family support elsewhere, they don't know a language to, that would enable them to travel to the nearby city or town or country. In other words, Hume says, you know, individuals are here and they obey because of habit. So this is Hume's critique of the contract. But there's a broader tradition of contract theory that, matter of fact, John Rawls, who revived social contract theory in the 20th century, he included Hume in the historical, he placed him among the historical figures who articulated a broadly contractarian vision. So Rawls thought that the liberal conception of justice in society was a contractarian one. And he traces this all the way back to Glaucon in Plato's Republic. He traces it to Epicurus, the Hellenistic philosopher, and the ancient Epicureans of all the ancient philosophical sects. They were really the only major sects to renounce Socrates and to go about morals and politics in a different way. And Epicurus, for example, said justice is nothing but pact made among utility-seeking individuals, self-interested individuals, not to harm in return for not being harmed. And so justice is not natural, it is artificial, it is man-made, it is created, and it is created for mutual advantage. And so this narrative, this precludes a pre-political natural law. It does not include in our political reasoning the idea of the noble. Matter of fact, Epicurus said he spits on the idea of the noble. And coincidentally, Hume himself did not include this conception of the noble in his theory of the virtues, which is why Thomas Reid, another major light in the Scottish Enlightenment, said Hume can be placed among the ancient Epicureans in this sense. So this is what contract theory is, what it does, and why Hume himself does not quite escape that broader contractarian imagination.
Very good. There's another formula, you know, social contract, but this is from, you mentioned Mandeville earlier, his famous Fable of the Bees. And he had this this statement, private vices, public virtues. What did that little saying, that truism, mean? And how does it figure in Hume's formation about vices and virtues?
Yeah, excellent question. Bernard Mandeville, he had a nickname too, Mandevil. He was a Dutch doctor and satirist. He lived in England. And so he wrote this famous commentary on a poem, Fable of the Bees, as you said, Private Vices, Public Benefits. And his idea is, if you make everybody, you know, into this ideal of a perfectly virtuous sort of ascetic, monastic figure, well, you're not going to have any economy. Your whole society is going to collapse. He said, well, you know, doctors, we require sick people. Yeah, right. And for wealth, well, you need greedy people to.
Well, what are going to happen to the people who own pubs?
Yeah, exactly.
Come on.
Exactly. You know, I was just teaching on the Reformation, and Calvin, he tried to create, I don't know if you know this, devotional taverns. He tried to convert taverns into devotional spaces. At the tap, you have a Bible.
I'm sure it worked perfectly.
Yeah, it worked for 1 month, which is surprising. But now you might know why Hume was no Calvinist. But he had a Calvinist kind of influence, and part of that was considering morality, you know, in this sort of rigid way. You know, I mean, I think Mandeville and Hume are highly critical of this monastic vision. I mean, Hume condemns the monastic virtues, you know, humility, self-sacrifice, self-denial, frugality. And his is very much a worldly kind of approach to virtue. And so Mandeville was critiqued by Francis Hutcheson, and Hume follows up, and I think he tries to soften Mandeville, but to a large extent agrees with Mandeville, and so tries to reform Mandeville, make him less controversial. One of Hume's major essays, called Of Refinement in the Arts, was first called Of Luxury, and he apologizes for, or gives an apology for, the more luxurious and commercial ages, which he thinks are inextricably linked with knowledge, humanity, and industry. But he changes the title, right? It was first Of Luxury, and then it becomes Of Refinement in the Arts. So Hume knows what he's doing, but he's subtle about it.
Yeah. He wanted his political theory to be scientific, you say. That was very important to him. What would be an example for him of an unscientific theory, political theory?
Yes. So Hume thinks, I mean, he has a sort of historical, somewhat evolutionary approach to the development of justice and society. And, I mean, he thinks that that religion was a first go at trying, for human beings trying to make a home for themselves in the world. And so this would consist of efforts to, base justice on perhaps merit, or bestow property on certain individuals based on certain religious insights or something like this. But Hume thinks that the laws of justice, which he thinks of as private property, the transference of that property by consent, the keeping of promises, these are ways that positively build on natural, what he would think of as natural human inclinations, right? To possess and to trade and to make a living and to live peaceably. And so he thinks, you know, human beings need to make a living. They're more concerned with living without interference than they are with anything else. He says all the religious beliefs, the metaphysical beliefs, they don't really do much, because he says there are so many bad theists out there, and there are good atheists. So he says it seems as if human beings are slaves to their passions, right? They act upon their passions more than their beliefs. And that's why Hume is famous for saying reason is and ought always to be the slave of the passions. So he says human beings are passionate creatures, you know, they act in predictable ways, so acting on that is what makes politics scientific, whereas, you know, these entering the kingdom of God, he would say, through baptism, these kind of rites, that doesn't do anything to make people better. That's his argument. Like, if you want peace and safety, justice will get you there. and all the religious stuff won't really get you there. But my question for Hume is, it's too bad I can't ask him. He's been dead for many, many years now. But, you know, if religion didn't have an effect on morals, then how could he claim that they have such a bad effect on morals? It would seem that it would be a wash. You know, it wouldn't matter what your beliefs are. But he says that, no, they actually make you a worse person. And so that would mean that, well, there's something to belief. Belief matters. And indeed, Hume testifies to that because he wrote, you know, he popularized his political science and considered himself an ambassador from learned circles to circles of conversation.
Yeah. You know, you talk about him devising ways to moderate or maybe to convert this creature of passions into a liberal citizen, you know, able to get along. And you actually write that we can do that quote. You write this: when men discover that their passion for gain is best satisfied by moderating in accordance with the rules of society. In other words, I'm not eliminating the passion, the selfishness, put it, you know, in lesser terms, but actually we got to build a society, a political theory that will show that moderation. You're going to get what you want, even better than before. Is that the idea overall?
That is the idea for Hume. I mean, for Hume, he says, think about what would happen if nobody abided by any of these laws. You know, you would have nothing. And so the trade-off is you temper that pursuit, you follow the rules, you abide by those rules, and you will gain in the end. Just like you said it beautifully, that is what Hume thinks. And he thinks that, you know, sympathy, we will sympathize with the public good. So really, at first, we abide by the laws of justice out of self-interest. But eventually, you know, we come to see and sympathize with the benefits of being a law-abiding citizen.
And you just have to accept self-love as the prime motivation. So, you know, Rousseau coming along and saying, hey, private property, bad thing. Forget it. That actually would be a denial of self-love rather than private property would be a sublimation of self-love, a way to get along with. Let me go back to the religious issue. You note that Hobbes regarded Christianity as a genuine, quote, obstacle to civilization. You write, was Hume that strong? Christianity is an obstacle to civilization.
I think he was. Now, I mean, there's some nuance here, but I'll put it this way. In Hume's history, best-selling history, from 1754 to 1762, they were published 6 volumes, History of England. John B. Stuart, a Hume scholar from the 20th century, said, for someone known as a historian, gosh, Hume seems to have hated history, because he looks back at ancient history, the feudal era, Christendom, and he just doesn't have much good to say about it. But then we come to the modern Tudor ages, and he says, ah, this is where history becomes useful. This is where it becomes, history becomes scientific. You have the centralization of the state. You have the development of civilization. This is what we can learn from. And so Hume does not think highly of the decentralized feudal era or any liberty that might have been fostered there. He does not think very highly of Christendom. One thing he says, if religion does a good thing, it's by accident. The English Civil Wars, the Puritans were fanatics, but hey, they contributed to the development of civil liberty in England. So thankfully, you know, their enthusiasm flamed out. And of course, there was lots of bloodshed. But hey, in the long run, it ended up working out. He does say a good thing about the Catholic Church as well. I mean, the preservation of manuscripts, of the Justinian Codex, Roman law. The Catholic Church preserved this, and he acknowledges that. At the same time, you know, Hume's history, I would put it this way, whereas the classical political philosophers had different regime types for politics: monarchy, aristocracy, democracy or polity, mixed government. And the idea was rule by how many and rule for the good of whom. And the best form of government was that which best promoted the common good. For Hume and for Adam Smith, I would say, it's more of a, you know, a progressive regime is the best one. And what do I mean by a progressive regime? I mean one that it has advanced beyond savagery and barbarism, beyond, you know, feudalism, beyond Christendom, and makes way for a kind of politics of humanity, right? Where it's just sympathy that carries us on to moderate our self-gain, our desire for self-gain, just enough to get along and make a community possible. And he thinks, you know, the more we gain, the better it will be. Hume had a cyclical conception of history in some sense, like the history of arts and poetry, there'll be ups and downs. But when it came to the benefits of market society, Hume seemed to indicate that there was an upward spiral. I mean, he wasn't a utopian thinker. He didn't think our political regime could be perfected. But boy, was he confident in market society and its benefits.
There's a lot more in the book, the discussion of what the utilitarians took from Hume. Also, the note that there is a certain conservative element in Hume's liberalism, mostly what Professor Zubia mentions as the defense of counter-revolution, and also a defense of common life, right? Ordinary life of ordinary people. But for now, the book is The Political Thought of David Hume, The Origins of Liberalism and the Modern Political Imagination. Professor Zubia, thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much.